Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. When you think of the Indianapolis 500, General Motors' smaller Saturn car doesn't generally spring to mind, but from now on, it might. That's because former race car driver and mega car dealership owner Roger Penske announced today that he plans to buy Saturn. Penske, who also owns Indy 500 and NASCAR racing teams, won't say how much he's paying, but the tentative deal is expected to save 13,000 jobs and allow all 350 Saturn dealerships to stay open, at least for now. Earlier this week, GM said it would sell Hummer to a Chinese company as it pares down to four core brands as part of its bankruptcy restructuring. Joining us is Micheline Maynard of the New York Times. And Mickey, months ago, GM said it would sell Saturn. So how important is this tentative deal to its restructuring?
Well, it's an important step because one of the things that General Motors has to do is get rid of several brands, Saturn, Pontiac, Hummer, and Saab. And for Saturn, it's really a good move because it means that Saturn, which was created about 20 years ago, will live on, and its dealers, many of its dealers, will stay open as a result of this.
Now, Penske said he will sell cars produced by GM, but he also can sell other brands.
That's right, and it's going to be very interesting to see the mix of vehicles that he puts in Saturn. Saturn has had kind of a rocky history. It started out in 1990 selling small cars, and then arguments were made to give it bigger products, but GM had a lot of other brands that it had to feed. So for about 5 years in the 1990s, it got no products whatsoever. It just sort of was starving. Then it got some new vehicles. It got the View Sport Utility, which has been very successful for it. It got some new cars, and now the Saturn dealership, the Saturn lineup is probably the broadest it's ever been at a time when General Motors is selling the franchise.
It was supposed to be a different kind of car company when GM launched it 19 years ago, isn't that right?
Yes, it was supposed to be a company that would appeal to people who had bought Hondas and Toyotas. General Motors was afraid that it was going to lose baby boom consumers, people who had moved over to Toyota and Honda. So this was its answer, and it actually did a very good job of getting people who were owners of imports. It was more than 60% of the people that were buying those early Saturns did own Japanese cars.
And then let's talk about what Penske might be able to do here that GM could not. First of all, tell us a little bit about him. He owns, what, the nation's second largest auto dealership chain?
Well, that's right, but more important, I think people who follow racing know Roger Penske because he was a championship race car driver. He owns actually the team that won Indy 500 a couple weeks ago. Helio Castroneves is one of his drivers, so he's very well known in the racing world. He's also very well known as an entrepreneur in the auto industry. I think he has the second largest dealership network, as you said. He's the distributor of the Smart Car in the United States, which is a little car built by Mercedes. And then he also has had rental trucks. He has had parts operations, engines. This guy is just a jack of all trades in the auto industry.
And so what do you think he brings to this that might put him in a good position to be able to succeed with Saturn where GM could not?
Well, this is a car guy, and this is someone who really believes in automobiles, and he's a tremendous personality, and I think he's one of the most interesting people in the auto business. I mean, obviously, there's been personalities before who couldn't run car companies, but he's a hard-nosed businessman. He knows how to deal with suppliers. He knows how to deal with the public, and this is a real boost for Saturn.
And now this deal is expected to save the 13,000 jobs at Saturn and allow the dealers to stay open, as we said in the beginning. Do we know if that's sort of a permanent promise, or is that still kind of in flux?
Well, it all depends on how it's able to do. You know, these poor divisions at General Motors have really been buffeted by, will they stay open, will they close, will the plant stay open, you know, who's going to lose their jobs. And at least it gives Saturn a little bit of stability. Now, it depends on how long it wants to buy cars from General Motors and whether he'll branch out. There are a lot of car makers around the world that don't sell automobiles in the United States because they didn't want to go to the bother of setting up a dealership network. We haven't had Renault for years. We actually haven't had Fiat for years, and they're teaming up with Chrysler. Companies like Peugeot and Citroën in France. So Americans might actually get to see some of the vehicles that are sold around the world everywhere here.
What about Saturn owners right now? What if they need service or they have warranties? Do we know how this deal might affect them?
Right. Well, Saturn warranties remain in effect, and anyone who buys a new vehicle, the government has said it will honor the warranties of General Motors products sold in bankruptcy. Now, I think we'll have to find out whether that same guarantee would apply to Saturn, but now that it's bought by Roger Penske, I'm assuming that the Penske organization will be honoring those warranties.
And just briefly, Mickey, what does this whole thing say about GM's longer-term chances for survival?
It does say that they're able to sell Saturn. I'm not sure what it says about their longer-term chances, because I actually thought Saturn was one of the more promising parts of General Motors, and I think there are probably people inside the company that hate to see it go. But we're going to find out over the next few months what GM will look like when it comes out of bankruptcy and what its long-term prospects are.
All right. Micheline Maynard, senior business writer for the New York Times, talking with us today about the tentative deal for GM to sell its Saturn brand to Roger Penske. Mickey, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk with you again.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
We want to turn now to one of the poorest and least developed countries in the world, Nepal. Almost a third of its population lives on less than a dollar a day, and political turmoil has displaced tens of thousands of people. For Nepalese women, life is particularly difficult. The country has a long record of discrimination and exploitation, and maternal mortality in Nepal has historically been among the highest in Asia. Dr. Sangeeta Mishra is trying to change that. She's a gynecologist from Nepal. For the past 11 months, she's been studying public health as a Fulbright scholar at Johns Hopkins University. And we caught up with Dr. Mishra before she returned to Nepal, and I asked her to explain how women's health issues are addressed there.
These women, they are not coming to the clinics. They don't have access to the hospital. So sitting in a clinic and solving the problem for one-on-one basis, it doesn't work for Nepal.
So some of the specifics, what would you do specifically in Nepal based on what you've learned here in the U.S. at Johns Hopkins?
First thing which I realized the major problem in Nepal was high rate of maternal mortality, and women were dying due to the pregnancy-related complications. Women don't know, they are not aware of pregnancy. They think it's just a normal thing and they can deliver at home, and they are not aware of the consequences that pregnancy can bring in. So I plan to develop a major educational and awareness generation program for these rural women where most of the deaths occur, to aware them about the importance of delivering at hospital or having a skilled help or skilled attendance at home. So that's my plan.
Now, you said most of the women are in the rural areas. Is that right?
Yeah. Around 68% women live in rural areas. And if you talk about how many women deliver at hospital, it's just 16%. That's striking.
Yeah.
And there are certain women that can get some help while delivering at the home with nurses and skilled professionals. It's just 24%.
Is there something culturally happening in Nepal that tells women that they don't need to have any sort of assistance or medical attention when they give birth, particularly in the rural areas?
Yeah, it's a part of the culture, because in the family, like mother-in-laws or the mothers, they believe that because they didn't had any complication and they delivered at home, so they think that their daughters-in-law and daughters, they should also deliver at home. What these women don't realize that they delivered 10 kids at home, but how many were alive? Like out of 10, you have only 4 or 5 kids alive. So now in this era, you cannot deliver 10 children and then you have 2 or 3 of them alive. You should have 2 or 3 kids and all of them should be alive. When you see the percentage of babies who die immediately after birth, it is almost 35% of neonatal death in the early period, like in the first 1 month of the life. And one of the most common causes of neonatal death is hypothermia, and the other one is sepsis. So what happens, there are certain practices in Nepal and other South Asian countries, because as I told you, women essentially deliver in houses. So they don't use the clean blades to cut the cord. Mm-hmm. So there are the chances of getting infection because they are using the old plate or anything available in the house.
Like to cut the umbilical
cord of the baby from the mother. So what happens, there are chances of infections. Right. So one reason of neonatal death is that after that. Other thing is, there is a practice, they think that once baby is delivered, it has to be bathed. So what they do, they wash the baby. And because these houses are mud-built houses, the temperature is not controlled. So what happens, baby has been for 9 and 9.5 months in the uterus in a very controlled temperature, in a very safe environment. And once it comes out, you are bathing it in a cold water, but you are not essentially drying it properly. So baby develops hypothermia. That is one of the most common cause of neonatal death. And the other thing is breastfeeding. Sometimes people think that the first milk, like the colostrum, which mm-hmm. we say, is not good for baby, and they discard it. So till women get white milk, they wait till white milk
comes.
They
won't feed the baby.
They won't feed the baby. Mm. Or they will feed with sugar water, which is very harmful. So, you know, you need to address all these issues in order to tell them, like, no, it's not correct.
Now, in terms of women and the status of women overall, are women educated?
Let me put it this way. Education and health is not the priority for the common people. The understanding is like, you need to eat, you need to earn your livelihood. And for that, they don't think that education is the best way. So we have female literacy around 47%. I'm talking about literacy, I'm not talking about higher education. And then there is gender inequality and all others. These are the cultural things we are improving. And it's good in recent year to see all these girls going to the school. But obviously, yeah, we have a long way to go.
Now, with a 47% literacy rate, I'm wondering, isn't that an enormous obstacle if you're trying to develop an education program to get to these women to tell them about why medical attention might be helpful for them when they're giving birth? How do you do that when you don't have a literate population?
That's a very good question. My understanding is that even if somebody is uneducated, you can tailor your messages according to them. So you can use audiovisual programs, you can make radio programs, and you can just transmit it. And then Nepal is very good in having a huge network of community health volunteers. So these are the female community health volunteers, and they go door by door and they can educate these women. So essentially, you are not actually developing a brochure or a booklet and giving these women. You are doing a one-on-one educational program. It will be a like a focus group discussion. You can have a mother's group, and then you can initiate discussion and tell them why it is important. All these issues are social issues. So you need to work with the people who are from the social work sector and from the paramedical staffs to tailor your educational and scientific programs according to the social issues and how it will be your socially acceptable and culturally acceptable.
Dr. Sangeeta Mishra is a gynecologist from Nepal. For much of the last year, she's been studying public health as a Fulbright scholar at Johns Hopkins University, where she focused on family and reproductive health. We'll have more of our conversation with her after a quick break. Coming up later in the show, ahead of the 65th anniversary of D-Day, we look back at the prayer delivered by President Roosevelt. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about child and maternal health in Nepal, which is one of the poorest countries in the world. Its economy is heavily dependent on international aid and tourism, and most Nepalese earn their livelihoods as farmers. The Himalayan nation has also emerged from a long civil war, and needless to say, health care in a country like Nepal is a challenge. Dr. Sangeeta Mishra is a gynecologist from Nepal who studied in the U.S. as a Fulbright scholar. She just returned home after a year here. I spoke with her as she was wrapping up her studies, and I asked her to give us a fuller picture of life for Nepalese women, especially women in the countryside.
In Nepal, usually our median age of marriage is 17 years, and essentially they start delivering kids at the age of 18 or 18.5. Then usually a Nepali woman has 3 to 4 children, but some women have 8, 9 children. So And all these women, usually they deliver at home with the help of their mother-in-laws or the neighbors or friends. And there are some traditional birth attendants. These birth attendants are an uneducated class of women. They come to your house and then they deliver you and then they go back. They don't have any medical skills. So there are certain harmful practices which they apply, like pressing your abdomen during the childbirth, which can be very dangerous. It can lead to rupture of the uterus and all sorts of problems. And regarding the household work, average woman has to work in the house as well as in the fields, like because agriculture is one of the most important livelihoods. So women go to work in the farms. The women are more responsible for taking care of the family, like cooking food. They have to take care of their kids. So I think essentially a woman in rural Nepal works around 14 hours a day. Hmm. And without getting paid for it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And compared to the men?
Men are mainly has more of an economic role. So they essentially go to the fields or whatever work they do, they will go to the work. And women has to do the household work as well as they have to help in the fields.
Mm. So is the health of women valued, would you say, overall, or not necessarily? Or is it valued because of what they need to do to organize the household?
I think it's... I should not use this word valued, but think it's neglected, I mean to say. Because when you go to an average rural Nepali house, what you will find, like she cooks the food, she prepares everything, and she will let everyone eat first, like husband and like her parents, in-laws, the kids, and whatever is left over, she survives on that food. So I think nutritionally she is not very conscious, and I think it's a bit neglected.
So if there is an increased effort to improve health for the women in these villages, and if your effort is successful, will the men in the villages be accepting of the women's efforts to take better care of themselves?
Yeah, that's the main agenda of my approach. I'm trying to educate, not only educate these women, I'm trying to educate these men as partners and the family members, so that they are more aware of the issues going on with pregnancy and other health issues. Because if you don't involve men and mothers-in-laws and fathers-in-laws in the family, you are not going to achieve anything because they are the decision-makers.
What about other health issues for women, aside from giving birth? Are there other issues that are problematic that you hope to focus on as well?
Yeah. I did a small study. I went to this village and I tried to interview these women. And then I tried to find out how many of these women knew about cervical cancer. And then there is a test called visual inspection under acetic acid. It is a counterpart of pap smear, but it is a very low cost. So what essentially I did, I tried to assess the knowledge of these women, and then I tried to have a sense how many of these women were prone to developing cancers. So what I found, that no woman knew about cervical cancer. 2% of the women knew about uterine cancer, but they didn't know what was the difference between a uterine cancer and a cervical cancer. Mm. And that was very striking to me. So that is one thing which is my recent interest, is like I'm thinking about developing a program using this acetic acid method to all the village levels. And the beauty of this test is that it can be done through nurses. You don't require a gynecologist to do it. You see, all these women, they work in the field. They grow crops, and they cannot come to the hospital. So you need to go to them.
Some people might be listening, and they might think your story as a successful doctor and a Fulbright scholar and a woman from Nepal, some people might think that, maybe it is feasible for a woman from Nepal to be successful.
I will just say one line, that I don't reflect an average Nepali woman. I don't represent Nepal. I, along with my other colleagues, like female doctors or the other women professionals, we have been very advantaged. We are really lucky that we got to this stage. But believe me, we don't represent. We are just these 2-3%. So if you look at me and you think, oh, women in Nepal are like this, no, they are not. Mm. I'm very sincere in saying this. Mm. It's very tough to come to this stage, but now once we have come to the stage, I think it's my social responsibility to do something. At least I don't say that we can make everybody a doctor or engineer or a professional, but at least we can educate them. And once you educate women, they are empowered. Then they can decide for themselves what is right and what is wrong.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Sangeeta Mishra. She's a gynecologist in Nepal. She was recently in the U.S. as a Fulbright scholar studying public health at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Monday on Here and Now, Jack Kerouac, fantasy baseball player. Apparently, he invented an intricate fantasy sports game that he played his entire life. That's coming up Monday. We'll be back after the news, Here and Now. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he's not arrogant and he has no plans to step down, but he is fighting for his political life as he tries to recover from a scandal involving expense claims by lawmakers, several high-level resignations, and some dismal local election results. Six of Brown's cabinet members resigned in the past few days. One of them, Work and Pension Secretary James Purnell, was considered a rising political star, but in his dramatic resignation, he said Brown should quit too for the sake of the Labour Party. Here's the leader of the opposition party, Conservative David Cameron.
Well, I think the events of the last 2 days show that this government has completely forfeited its right to govern. And more to the point, I think the whole country will be thinking, don't we deserve better than this?
But lawmakers from Cameron's party are also part of the expense scandal for charging the public for items such as a house for ducks, pornography, and cleaning the moat of a country mansion. One member of parliament even claimed less than a dollar for a box of matches. Nick Childs is the BBC's political correspondent, and he joins us now from Westminster. And Nick, first of all, you're outside parliament today. What's the mood like there?
Well, I think it's one of bated breath and astonishment, because it really has been a pendulum swing in a real crisis here. Just a few hours ago, Gordon Brown's position looked really precarious after the resignation of James Purnell, one of his cabinet ministers, who then said he should stand down. And everyone was waiting to see if others would follow. In fact, in terms of senior cabinet ministers, they didn't. They rallied round him and publicly gave their support. And I think with the cabinet reshuffle that he's just done now, he's come out and given this defiant message that he's not going to walk away, that he's got a job to do, as you were saying earlier. I think he's eased the pressure on him, and the pendulum, if you like, has swung the other way a little bit. But how far and whether he's out of the woods yet, I think it's very early to say, because the atmosphere is such that it's incredibly unpredictable at the moment.
Hmm. How are members of the public reacting?
Well, we've had elections for local government and European parliamentary elections. The results are just coming out now, but clearly the governing Labour Party has done very badly, as expected. The other main parties perhaps aren't doing as well as they would have liked, but I think that is a reflection of what everyone had been expecting, which is that the public is extremely angry about the expenses row. It's really stirred the public and created a kind of friction and a gap between the public and politicians, which most people say they can't remember ever having existed. And the fact that it's gone on for so long is, I think, a reflection of the sense of crisis.
Hmm. But these expense claims, while they're certainly embarrassing, they're not illegal, isn't that right?
Well, there are a range of them which have come to light from people essentially playing the system, if you like, to wider abuses and things that people clearly think are totally unacceptable, to some which potentially are not only breaking the rules, but might actually be against the law. So all that's being looked into. But the sense that everybody is at it in Parliament, I think, has gripped the nation. A lot of politicians say that's unfair, and a lot of politicians say the judgments people are making are arbitrary, and just what you've done doesn't actually have an impact on what happens to you in terms of whether you're being forced to stand down or whatever. But a lot of other people are saying, you know, the public is right. It's not good enough to say it was okay by the rules. It's particularly given the economic situation. And there is a perfect storm, if you like, of the economic downturn and the expenses row going on here. Given all that, it's totally unreasonable that some of these expenses were in the rules, and that's why there is not only a demand for radical change of the rules, but also people saying we need to go further and look at constitutional reform and how accountable MPs are and clean up the whole system.
Very quickly, Nick, do you think Gordon Brown is going to be able to hang on?
It's very difficult. He's certainly eased the pressure on him at the moment, but people will digest this cabinet reshuffle and listen to what he said, whether the message really has changed and they feel more confident with him. It's a crucial time, but the next few days, I think, remain unpredictable.
Okay, Nick Childs, BBC political correspondent, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a bit. Here and Now.
The announcement has just been made that the invasion of Western Europe has begun. The feints and diversions promised by Winston Churchill and hinted at by the military experts have now been relegated to the limbo of dead words. For as a million people will say today, this is really it.
Tomorrow marks the 65th anniversary of D-Day, the massive Allied invasion of Europe that eventually helped end World War II. Allied troops, including men like Norman Grossman of Newton, Massachusetts, poured out of their landing crafts into the teeth of German machine gun fire. Here, he reads from a diary where he wrote about that day.
We were on the beach about 2 hours. During that time, the shells burst all around us. I saw one shell burst among a group of soldiers just as they were running off the assault boat. I turned my head quickly so I wouldn't see the result.
On June 6, 1944, Norman Grossman was a 19-year-old private in the 29th Infantry Division. He was in the first wave of troops to land on Omaha Beach. While he and thousands of other Allied troops were fighting and dying on the beaches of France, Americans back home were glued to their radios for news of the invasion.
There are 1,000 stories behind the short communique which merely told us that our men had landed. Those of us who have been on other amphibious landings can imagine how our men felt last night when they were finally told that their long months of waiting were over. As long as these men live, the evening of June 5th will always be to them the night before D-Day.
That was CBS commentator Quentin Reynolds on the air in the first hours after the invasion. Later that night, at about 10 p.m. Eastern Time, President Franklin Roosevelt spoke to the nation. But it wasn't really a speech. It was more a prayer called Let Our Hearts Be Stout.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
That's President Franklin Roosevelt speaking to the nation on June 6, 1944. We'll hear more from FDR's D-Day prayer in a minute, and you can listen to all of it at our website, hereandnow.org. But first, we want to turn to Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. Julian, give us the context for this moment. Everyone knew the invasion was coming. They just didn't know where or when.
Well, this was a country that was already weary from war. It had been a very, you know, brutal few years. It had been a war that drained the home front. Rome had just been liberated the night before, and Americans had learned about this through an address from FDR, and they knew more was coming. But the invasion itself was still top secret, so this was a surprise in terms of when it happened and how it happened when Americans learned of this in the morning.
And how unusual for a president to deliver a prayer like this?
Well, it's not as unusual as we think. I mean, presidents have frequently invoked God long before FDR, and there had been calls for national prayer. Even Abraham Lincoln did this. And FDR himself had done this earlier in his presidency. But But obviously, by this point, America is in the war. The war has been going on for a while, and this is a moment when the beginning of the end is approaching. And so it's not unusual, but it was still a very historic day of prayer, and many Americans felt elation even as they were still fearful.
But certainly not something that we're accustomed to hearing from a president of today.
No, not at all. What's remarkable, though, if you look at the newspapers after the prayer, nothing's really noted about some special day of prayer, some special call for prayer. What the newspapers at the time were more interested in was the invasion itself and really kind of joining the president in this moment. But the prayer itself was not seen at the time as something very dramatic.
Let's listen to another passage from the prayer, if we can.
Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in a continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, I think, important statement where he's talking about the idea this is not just a prayer for a few minutes, but it's a prayer that should be continued. He says, you know, I ask that our people devote themselves to in a continuance of prayer as we rise each day. And again, when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our effort. And in the next sentence, he talks about the need to redouble contributions we make in the physical and material support of our armed forces. That's classic FDR, calling on the nation to contribute, calling on the nation to sacrifice in this time of war. It was very much how he thought about how wartime should be conducted.
Do we know if Roosevelt wrote this himself?
Yes. I mean, according to all the accounts, he was up very late the night before after he delivers this address about the liberation of Rome, and he's kind of hidden away writing this speech. There is speculation that others might have helped him, but he is responsible for this. And most accounts say as he's getting reports about what's going on in the war front, he's still trying to perfect this speech the next day. It's delivered to reporters around, I think, 11 in the morning so that people can have this in front of them and know about it by the night when he asks everyone to join him.
And what about the language that he uses in this prayer? He was famous for his fireside chats, obviously, but was the language any different here, do you think, and how?
Well, obviously, I mean, the fireside chats were not as religious. This is a religious moment being used to explain and to ask Americans to deal with a critical moment in the war. But in many ways, it's still classic FDR. What we heard in the fireside speeches, he's telling Americans what's happening. If you read the passages, he's talking about the fact this can be brutal, this can be difficult. He reminds Americans of why they're doing this. He talks about kind of a battle against a fundamentally evil force. And then, though, he reminds them that victory will be ahead. That's the same structure of many of the fireside speeches, even though the text itself is obviously much more about faith, much more about God.
And what happened after he spoke? How did his prayer resonate with people?
Oh, my gosh. It really resonated in ways that today, I guess, would be hard to imagine. There are accounts that Americans kind of fell to their knees wherever they were in streets on their front porches and said this prayer with the president. In Madison Square Garden in New York City, there were over 50,000 people who came to say the prayer there. And in churches across the cities, public officials, mayors, and governors led prayers as well. So it really was a national moment of prayer. And I think it captures the sense of this being a total war where Americans were living with it every day. And there was a sense with this invasion that it really might be the start of the end.
Well, Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School. He's been speaking with us about FDR's D-Day prayer on June 6th, 1944. By the way, you can hear the entire prayer and read the text by going to our website, hereandnow.org. Julian, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Here and Now. In the new young adult novel, If I Stay, 17-year-old Mia wakes up to a snow day from school. Things start out in a pretty routine way. She's listening to a Beethoven sonata while riding in her family's car, but suddenly she's faced with the question, how much does she really want to live? Mia, a talented cellist, is in a coma after the car accident that kills every member of her family, her mother, father, and brother Teddy. The book follows the next 24 hours as Mia remembers the life she had and tries to decide whether to continue to live it. If I Stay has been optioned for a film, and Catherine Hardwicke, the director of last year's Twilight movie, is set to direct. Gail Forman is author of If I Stay, and she joins us from the Argo Network Studios in New York. Gail, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Most of the Mia that we meet in your book is a character who's out of body, but she's remembering the life that she had, and it was a pretty good life up until that point.
Yeah, she's got a pretty rich life for a 17-year-old. Pretty unusual life, too. She is unusual for a lot of teenagers, I think, in that she's got a pretty great relationship with her parents.
And why did you decide to have such a strong relationship with, a 17-year-old and parents, which is not obviously a common occurrence all the time? Why was that?
That just seemed, these are parents who were sort of 22, 23-year-old kind of punk rockers who got pregnant unexpectedly and had this kid. And it just seemed that knowing people who'd been in that position and who'd had a child, and this child who Mia was, this character I'd created, that just seemed true to the people they would be. Mia's parents are kind of cooler than her, and she doesn't really have a lot to rebel against, but they're also very kind of loving and accepting of Mia.
And this relationship between Mia and her parents actually also makes her decision about whether to stay living a very difficult one.
It does. It's what has made her a person kind of brave enough and strong enough to even contemplate what she has to contemplate. But I think that throws into sort of stark relief what her choice really is. I mean, she has this incredibly promising future as a cellist. She has this really wonderful boyfriend, Adam, but her family is pretty incredible, and Mia knows that.
I'm wondering if I could ask you to read a part of the book where she talks about making this decision as she's really, comatose on her deathbed, and she's struggling with, do I have the will to go through a painful recovery and still live in this world without those very powerful influences on my life? Could you read an excerpt?
Sure. What would it feel like to wake up an orphan? To never smell Dad smoke a pipe, to never stand next to Mom quietly talking as we do the dishes, to never read Teddy another chapter of Harry Potter, to stay without them. I'm not sure this is a world I belong in anymore. I'm not sure that I want to wake up.
It's interesting that she struggles with that question, and that it's not immediately clear that despite the fact that she has this very loving boyfriend and very promising career as she aspires to go to Juilliard, and it looks like she may actually get in, that she really wouldn't want to be in this life anymore.
Yeah, I mean, to wake up without your family, I just think that's incomprehensible. I mean, in some ways, it's that sort of horror fantasy that I think a lot of us sort of in the dark of night when we sit there nursing sort of horrible what-if fantasies, it's the kind of thing we think about. But this is something that Mia, at this point, has to sort of contemplate in very real terms.
Yeah. And let's talk about her boyfriend, Adam. That was obviously a very big influence on her life. Why did you decide to make this relationship so central and also make them seem so different on the outside? At least.
Well, Adam is sort of part of this whole rock and roll world that everybody else in the book, aside from Mia, is part of. And that's sort of the world that I knew and could write easily. Mia, as the cellist, was the outlier, and she sort of arrived in my brain fully formed as this cellist. And I was like, really? A cellist? And just after I wrote the first scene with Mia and Adam together, they go on a date to a Yo-Yo Ma concert. I just realized then that there was going to be this tug of war, and there were going to be the things that were pulling me Mia to keep her here and the things that were pulling her to go. And so Adam was clearly going to be one of the big things keeping her here. I mean, I think the book is a series of love stories, and there's the romantic love story angle with Adam, and then there's the music love story, you know, not just me and classical music, but love of music sort of filters through the entire book, and the family love story.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of the romance, if you will, I know mm-hmm. some folks have compared your book to Stephanie Meyer's Twilight and in the relationship there. That's a, you know, that is a very deep sort of love and outcasts in high school, and it seems to me a very different experience than a lot of people actually have in high school and talk about later. Do you think that there's some fantasy there?
Certainly. And, you know, when I wrote this book, the Adam character was named Nick, who is my husband's name. So I think that I was exploring some of my loving feelings for my husband. But part of what's going on with me and Adam is that their relationship is one of those relationships that I have seen with people where they fall in love in high school, and it's not a high school relationship. I think people tend to discount teenagers falling in love at that time. Oh, it's just your first love, or it's just puppy love. It doesn't mean anything. And I don't think it feels that way to a lot of teenagers, and I think in some cases it really isn't that way. I think some teenagers can actually have a kind of mature love.
Another part of this story is her own life, Mia's own life, and the love of music that I think is an important theme, and you touched on that before, but it's also obviously, I think, a part of her final decision.
Absolutely. People who think that it all comes down to the guy are misreading it. Her love of the guy and love of music are totally intertwined because they never would have got together. They're so different that music is what brought them together in the first place. But music plays a very big role in the sort of climactic scene and sort of has a very big impact on what her final decision is.
Mm-hmm. And so you think it's a story that resonates for teens in what way?
The love story, I think, really hits home with teens. Teens, I think, are drawn to stories about sort of stark moral choices. And I think a lot of teenagers are grappling with their own if-I-stay issues. I mean, luckily, not with stakes anywhere like Mia's stakes, but 17 is when a lot of teenagers are starting to think about separating from their family for the first time and sort of grappling with their own choices. And that's what this book comes down to. It's Mia's choice. So I think that resonates with teenagers.
Gail Forman's book is If I Stay. Gail, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.